listening to Indie Bay Radio out here in San Francisco. It's Friday morning on the 23rd. Of course, the Great Peace March is going to take place this weekend. Today is the first of the series of number of days on it. And live from the Jackson, Mississippi airport, we have Dave on the line. Hello, Dave. This is not Diamond Dave. Dave, too. And you're also involved with the camp down in Waveland, Mississippi?
Yes. I've been down there for 2 weeks now.
Great, great. So you were, apparently you're just up in the airport right now. You were driving people up there. You're acting as a shuttle service?
Yeah, well, when the storm was coming in, different people were doing different things. Most of the people, most of our cafe was just packing, you know, we packed up the tents and packed stuff up, and just people were just going to stay in the school bus and just gut it out as best they could. And we had good connections with the National Guard and stuff, so if the storm got really bad, they would get us out of there. But I left and because people the airports were all closed down all around there. They were open a little bit, but when Rita came in, they shut down again. So I ran some folks up to Jackson and got out of the, you know, get away from the storm as well. But
yeah.
I just talked to them on the phone, and they're up and running. They're serving people breakfast.
Yeah, that's great. You know, now this storm you're talking about is storm hurricane number two, Rita. And so looking at it on the map, it looks like it sort of grazed the southern part of the coast, Mississippi. Parts of Louisiana are apparently starting to get hit by it, and it is still aiming for East Texas or Western Louisiana. Still a big one, yeah.
Well, one of our buses headed to a safe place and plans to go there and set up as soon as it makes landfall. Where in Waveland, according to what I heard this morning, they got torrential rains. They got a lot of rain and some wind. And somewhere there was a tornado not far from there, they said, they were telling me. But it's passed there in Waveland. And they're serving breakfast. So.
Yeah, well, that's inevitable with hot air, hot weather, and tornadoes do get spawned by hurricanes in certain conditions. So you got torrential type rains again, and you were saying that conditions down there have gotten bad. I would take it that after the Katrina, things at least had started to dry out, and the mosquito problem got abated. But now this fresh rain is going to make a lot of new spawning grounds in puddles and whatnot, huh? Plus, the smell is probably getting pretty intense. Any kind of rot that was starting to dry out is going to get opened fresh again, eh?
Yeah, it'll be mosquitoes. But like also, people did have some rudimentary provisions. You know, there were kitchens at people's. You know, people had set up tents and camps in their houses or in their yards where their houses were destroyed. So people had some rudimentary facilities at home. But now that's going to be that was pretty sketchy. So that the need for us to be there has gone up again. And, you know, the need's going to be there for a long time. This rain did just kind of mess things up, and things were starting to get together. And like I say, I'm not there, so I can't see it. But according to the phone call I got this morning from connecting with people there they're people are coming to breakfast. So they're serving them. So and we have a crew there. Even though some people left. And what I'm wondering about is what's going to happen now with Red Cross and FEMA and others. Are they going to head for wherever Rita makes landfall? And, you know, one way or another, we're going to have less to draw from, but that's okay. You know, we have our own resources, and we're going to hang there. So.
Well, one thing I was just considering with the enormous amount of privatization, the lack of privacy, the people have lost all of their possessions, and what little they have are pretty much being carried on their back. People who are homeless or have been homeless for the last couple of years are probably seen as pretty good guides for how to live. Are some of the homeless population taking a certain amount of charge because of their knowledge of survival?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if charge. Sort of, kind of, they're there. It's pretty clear who is who is experiencing emotional trauma because they lost all their material possessions. If you don't have any, then you know, you shrug your shoulders and you know it's just another day, right? I don't know if they're taking a leadership role, but they're definitely there. And I think a lot of the folks that were hanging around that were homeless also had options to get out of town and did. So, and of course, there's not much reason to come back. So there's three or four people that we know that are that have been hanging around camp that we know that, you know, we kind of know them and interacted with them, and they've been there, and they're an excellent source of information for us. And I don't know if, you know, I mean, Mother Nature is the great leveler, right? You know, people who are in line that are being served that aren't used to it are, of course, you know, experiencing a lot of emotional issues. And that's another part of what we're doing, you know, is like helping people to get over that. They're going to need it, you know, and helping people to have the strength to rebuild their lives. You know, homeless people are, of course, resilient and are used to sleeping in a tent or, well, they're getting tents and stuff like that. Maybe they weren't used to having that. So they may even be doing better, some of them. There's like three or four people that are that have been around the cafe that, you know, come and go and interact with us, and they're clearly clearly someone for us to watch. I don't know if the other residents are watching them or have gained any new respect for them. We'll see in time.
Well, I'm thinking in particular, you know, under normal situations in any kind of civilization, when a disaster occurs and all of the shelters are knocked flat, in civilizations of past time, you would take what lumber you had, what building supplies you'd have, and you'd make makeshift kind of houses. In the modern world, there are zoning laws that say that you can't live in a temporary shack like that. And so that's one of the aspects that I'm wondering about. Are there people who are building sort of temporary shacks on their land, and whether they're going to catch problems from the city for this, or if there's going to be a kind of a temporary abatement of zoning laws so that people can get their stuff in order. You know, just building a little shed or something that you can take what meager possessions you are and keep them dry would make some sense.
Well, that is that's being facilitated by tents. You know, FEMA or Red Cross, I'm not sure who, but, you know, somebody has been bringing in large amounts of tents, and people have been setting them up. Also, a lot of people have campers and or have, you know, relatives or resources to where they're getting campers put on their land. Also, FEMA is starting to move in mobile homes and mobile trailers. I'm thinking that the big struggle now is going to be zoning. You know, what's going to get condemned and bulldozed away, and then what's going to get built there? How's that going to be zoned? Are, you know, reasonably priced houses going to be zoned out of the area? That's the question in my mind. You know, are people who are homeless going to now not be able to move around there because, you know, the whole place is going to upscale? I wonder. I've been wondering that about New Orleans as well. If they build a huge, new, expensive dike system and make the place super safe, what's that going to do to property values, and who's going to be able to live there? Is it going to be a huge gated community? You know, those are the questions on my mind. That's one of the reasons I want to stay long-term at Waveland, and even if I go home to Wisconsin and come back and forth, I would like to, you know, pay attention to how that plays out and perhaps have a voice in it, because I think it's real important that people that have an economic that I think that it's important that whole houses are available to everyone who wants to live there, every price, you know, range, rather than suddenly turn the place into a very exclusive resort and force out everybody who is economically marginalized.
Well,
it's just middle class, for that matter.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. The only aspect of that, though, that is kind of a wild card in all of this is that if the wealthy come in there and try to buy everything up at $1 an acre, and then you have two or three more hurricanes per year, they're going to essentially own everything and will essentially, because of their property ownership, make it so that no one can live there, and mm-hmm. it'll just get torn apart and become a sort of a because of zoning law or because of ownership laws, no one will be able to use it. It's kind of interesting. Jackson is is it about a third of the way up the state?
Oh, it's quite a ways, yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking at the hurricane map on one of the internet sites, and looking at Waveland, apparently they are still being hit by, I believe, what does it say, 96 to 110 mile an hour winds. So there's a pretty fierce storm going on down that way. According to this also, just, probably a little south, a little bit west of New Orleans, they're getting hit by somewhere 111 to 130 mile an hour winds. Looks like the highest winds are still off the shore, but that would still mean that the, well, there are some pretty high winds, maybe up to 125 mile an hour winds just off the coast of New Orleans, all the way into maybe as far as Central Texas, and some 100 mile an hour winds in South Texas, along the coast in South Texas. So this hurricane is moving about 10 miles an hour, and it apparently can't make up its mind where it's going to hit yet. So,
right.
Yeah, it's it may head slightly east or something and go back toward New Orleans. It's not a good picture there. And so this whole idea of being able to evacuate and ride it out, you know, we sure wish our best to Malik. Maybe we should give him a call, too.
Well, I'm heading down back to Waveland here shortly, but that's interesting because I had called them and they felt, you know, they said they were cooking breakfast, and so I hope they weren't in a just a calm or something and not realize it.
I'll
give them a call.
Yeah,
but I think that I'm pretty sure they're not setting up too much at this point. And also on site down there is, you know, Waveland is a major distribution center, and there's lots of National Guard and the police and FEMA and Red Cross and the different Christian organizations. I mean, they seem to be somewhat in the know there. I'm curious. I'm going to call back down there as soon as I get done talking with you and find out. You know,
sure. Well, actually, according to this map, New Orleans proper may be only getting about 50 mile an hour winds or something. So, you know, They're probably getting the trash is being moved around pretty ugly. You know, probably sheets of metal are flying through the air, but it's not, it's not with the ferocity of 100 miles an hour. It's only with, scooting along ground level as opposed to flying 20 feet off the ground, you know, and whatnot. So it's, it's hard to figure. Yeah,
I have a thought that, you were talking about property values and stuff. You know, it's like, I think that I'm thinking in long term, as far as disaster relief and rescue work that we're doing here, we may have to get used to this. That Gulf is incredibly warm, and our whole planet is getting incredibly warm, and we're having these what I call global mood swings, and this, we may as well get used to it. And if that Gulf doesn't warm up, if this is a semi-permanent trend, or permanent as far as we humans are concerned, you know, the wealthy can have the place because they're going to get whacked constantly. You know, that's just my thought on it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the whole point. They may be getting a pig in the poke, as that goes.
Right.
I don't know if you, you're familiar with this concept of jubilee, but there's an old law of Moses that says that every once in a while with natural disasters and things, especially things that were declared acts of God, this law of Moses said that all of the financial transactions had to be canceled. So that, you couldn't have a mortgage for 30 years or 10 years or anything else. If a natural disaster came along, those financial transactions would make it hard for rebuilding. So you have to have a jubilee in order to cancel all debts, and so everybody can get restarted again. And so that may be a real wild card, both for the rebuilding effort as well as dealing with global warming. Those who are polluting are deep in financial hock, and they've got huge liabilities over their head, and so they cannot admit that they're causing this damage. And as long as this money is hanging over their heads, they're going to refuse to admit it, and they're going to buy scientists to refuse to admit it, and they're going to lock us into legal battles when we should be doing something to clean up the planet. So Jubilee seems like a pretty bright idea at this point.
I'm all for that. Yeah. Let's have a jubilee. And what was that city in Japan? You know, the Kyoto Agreement.
Oh, Kyoto. Yeah, Kyoto.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and, you know, as much as, well, there, as much as everybody praises Al Gore for his environmental stance, part of the reason why the Kyoto Agreement fell apart was at the very last moment, he got together with the nuclear industry and declared that nuclear power plants were sustainable electrical system. And everybody in their right mind knows that nuclear is not a sustainable system, but he was able to declare it as such, and that was also part of the reason why Kyoto failed. And so, yeah, Kyoto is a good idea on its face, but it's the realities of it were had gotten pretty ugly by the corporate boys. So we definitely need some of this wisdom again to get us all back on track. Hey, yeah, we'll look forward to hearing. Is Dave flying out of there today? I thought he said he was planning on leaving today. Is that still the case?
Oh, I'm not sure because I've been gone now since yesterday. About in the early evening, late afternoon. So I'm not quite sure what his plans are, but I'm going to be making, as soon as I'm sure that my friend here is getting a flight or getting, you know, some more information, I'm going to be most likely making a mad dash back to Waveland. So I will get him this phone, which he has been calling you with, and he can, you know, give you a call and find out more. You'll find out more then.
Yeah, that's great. I sure appreciate it. And he's got both my numbers, so have him give a holler. Hey, we'll hang on the phone. We'll go back to a little music. Thanks for your reporting from the area. And you are listening to Indie Bay Radio here in San Francisco. And so today's update from Dave in Jackson, Mississippi.
Money is a bird, all a flutter when it alights, and a bit of a condor in departure. Money is a bird, a diurnal raptor to darkling need, while time flies ironically to downy death. Money is a bird, nocturnal if not too wide-eyed, when you fly around on it at night in the company of drunken painters. The next morning it's more colorful but fuzzy and ruffled, then finally calm, sensitive to the sound of itself bouncing brightly where it was thrown. Money is a bird, too, in the hands of a miser, a crow bulging and furtive in a short, thick sleeve, cawing and cawing that it isn't there. In the hands of a saint, it's rather a sparrow, festooning the air with ups and downs, wings wide, then pulled in with fastidiousness, for saints are ambivalent about worldly riches. Money is a bird, a songbird in the throat of extravagant wealth, and sings it fully. But as beauty may be and a beauteous being, it can too pliably fit the hollow bell of its own ringing, so the very reception makes the song sound wrong. Money is a rare bird in the hands of a poet, in which case, clearly, a high-strung lark that is apt to be flighty if not busy preening, though that very wingedness may make it mighty. Money is a bird and sticks to the gilded palms of the rich like a suckling pig in a wingless gravity of fat with other tasty assumptions, as cloying as that. Money is a bird in many a jungle of teeming conviction in a bright green and yellow accented suit. It can be counted upon as likely as not to be a parrot, mouthing that catechism of obsequious pearls whenever the boss is hovering near. Money is a vain bird, even fetching when wooden. Should it appear just ducky enough as decoy, where the passing fancy to reproduce condescends. In the end, this bird is forever fledgling. If not for height, then in appetite, aggrandized to shadowy omnipotence. Till circling low, it becomes a vulture that first sniffs at, then devours the corpse of your culture.
And you are listening to Indie Bay Radio here in San Francisco. Before we sign out with Dave, we were just getting in a little side conversation before we hung up, and forgot to mention there's a little micropower station going on in Waveland. Tell us again how things are going with that micropower.
Oh, it's been great. I mean, it broadcasts. If you picture us, we're in a large, large strip mall parking lot, and we pretty much have the whole thing, the radio station broadcasts all around that, as well as in the local neighborhood where people are. So it's great for disseminating information and various interviews. People are talking about what their, you know, what their experiences are and what they're doing. And we've had a lot of interactions also with the Christian organizations that are doing this relief work. And even though we've had some problems with the hierarchy or the their quote leadership, there's specific individuals have been, you know, have been a little kirk to us. But the local or the rank and file, you know, on the grassroots level, the people that are doing the work, I've been very impressed with that radio station and the fact that we've got all this kitchen facility that we show up and just put it together, and that we laugh a lot and don't have leaders and work hard and have a radio station, and you know they've been kind of smiling and nodding and like what they see. So it's been an interesting experience to interact with those organizations, because I suppose I don't have to tell people there's, you know, so much animosity along class/culture lines in this country. It's good to show up and be an example of how many untruths are told about people that are not Christian or you know, just different. You know, the xenophobia that gets pushed has been challenged here, and that the station has been a big part of that. I think they're pretty careful what music they play on the station, because you know, there are a lot of different people listening, not just, you know, folks that, not well, just a variety of people listening. And the interviews have been great, and everybody's well, you know, can go up to the studio is actually a school bus, so anybody can go there and get interviewed, you know, and a lot of people have. So it's been a real experience for everybody. Yeah.
Well, you know, as we were talking off air, I back when I was a kid, you could buy one of those little transmitters for, you know, 10 or 20 bucks or upwards of that if you wanted to get a good one. And what nowadays people are calling pirate radio like this, it was considered hobby radio in the old days. And it's one of these, the civil defense people actually encouraged people to have these transmitters in their neighborhoods, because, you know, if you had small accidents or you had local opportunities, you know, it's something that that each of the communities could create their own little radio station in a national emergency or local emergency, and you could have information spread very well with transistor radios and battery-powered systems like this. And so the idea of calling it pirate radio is actually kind of a hazard. We need to get back into the idea of calling it a hobby radio or community radio, something like that, that gives...
Micro radio.
Yeah, absolutely.
That one.
It
and I agree with you, but, you know, I like the term pirate radio, because, you know, I those are my heroes in history. You know, it's like when I look at what the British Navy was doing, and look at, you know, just basically what other, not, I don't mean to pick on Western culture, but what other cultures were doing. You know, the people who kind of flew the black flag and did their own thing, and I think they were much more democratic than most of the people who they were robbing. You know, but that's me. I like micro radio. Pirate radio slips out every now and then, but that's That's me.
Oh yeah, yeah. But it's there's a certain amount of glory, but in order to keep the civilization going, you know, in order to keep fresh water and food and everything, the agricultural system going, you know, we need to have some regularity too. And having those little transmitters out there is a very helpful thing. You know, I've been trying to push Stephen Dunifer and many of the other people who are in the micropower in the forefront of it to go out there on the 4th of July, go to the county fairs and have a booth there and start handing out the transmitters. You know, if people want to pay $20 or $50 or whatever, you know, true costs are a production, that's fine. But it's, you know, the idea that we should look at it as a civic right and a real... you know, whether or not it's a responsibility also or whether it's a pleasure for 90% of the time. But if it's sitting there waiting to be used in the time of a crisis, that's where they really stand their worth. And it's you also mentioned off the air that, you know, it sounds like maybe some of these Christian organizations are going to consider getting these in the future, too. If the national government is not going to do anything to develop community interaction in times of a disaster, these radio stations are going to be of profound importance. And one other little odd business about this, had you heard anything about, it was said that during the Katrina, the full force of it, and for a couple of few days afterwards, that ham radio was actually being... what's the word for it? People would apparently the military was jamming the ham radio signals. Ham radio was not able to communicate as effectively as they have in every historical disaster. And had you heard anything about a jamming down in there?
I haven't, but you know, now that you mention it, I'm definitely gonna ask around and find out. You know, when I first got down there, I mean, our tents were set up sloppy and our kitchen was not organized and there was poles all over the place because we just threw it up and started throwing down and, you know, worked. I mean, I didn't see anything but that kitchen for days and days. So a lot of that stuff I missed. Now we've got a lot more staff and we're a lot more organized. We've moved the kitchen into a better location, you know, just a few feet away. But, I mean, we've kind of got better organized. So I can start finding that sort of thing out, and I'm definitely going to pursue that because I'm interested. That's got my curiosity.
Yeah, I've read about it as well. I heard one of the, I'm not sure if it was Jim Bohannon's show. He had a ham radio person call in and talk about this specifically. It was it's one of those problems that if the jamming was going on with some intentional. Aspect to it, there's something very serious going on. Apparently the police department radios weren't working. As you know, fire and emergency systems were not working, and ham specifically was not working. So someone was jamming a lot of frequencies at once, and that does not bode well. It does bode more that there was some sabotage on the part of somebody up there, and it you know, we got to figure.
That could have been looters, too. They might have had enough sophisticated equipment to be able to jam the police so that they could get away with doing what they were doing, because they were in there quick. I saw lots of cars stripped, and I talked to one police officer who was extremely annoyed. As he put it, he was off saving lives, literally, and if he had had the help of those people who were stripping cars, he could have saved a lot more lives. And he was he even said that he was very hesitant the whole concept of shooting looters before this storm, but now he gets it. He was very, very upset because he literally said, he was off, you know, trying to dig people out of the rubble and out of the water and literally saving people's lives and trying to get them in and so that they wouldn't die of exposure. And then when he came back after doing that, there were several cars stripped. Somebody had come and gone. And if they would have, instead of doing that, if those individuals would have been doing what he was doing, there'd be a lot more people alive, and he was just vivid over that. You know, or you could tell just by, you know, the way he was describing it, he was doing his best to be poised, but extremely upset.
Yeah.
And so I would say, you know, I mean, the military, I don't know what their purpose would be, but I could see looters doing that. You know, that's just my personal thoughts, you know, and you know, just from what I saw, because it was interesting driving along and seeing where, you know, cars that had been, you know, shoved together, you know, and then a whole lot of them had their hoods cut off and their tires gone. you know, somebody came and went and sure. took what they wanted. So,
well, you know, if that happens on a large scale, that's one more good reason for Jubilee. All of a sudden, everything they stole becomes worthless. So.
Right, exactly. You know, they can have it anyway. Why bother? You know, go help somebody who needs their life saved.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, well, thanks again, Dave. We'll look forward to hearing more reports in the future.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Great. Thanks for good work. And again, we were listening from Jackson, Mississippi's airport. That's Dave, one of the good volunteers down there in Waveland. Apparently, he's doing a transport run up to the airport to get people on their way out of the region. And Waveland, Mississippi, along with the south coast there, is being pretty heavily buffeted around by the new Hurricane Rita, which... apparently, looking at the maps on Weather Underground, for example, it's looking like it's going to probably hit more along the Texas-Louisiana line instead of Houston proper. It's taking a slight more bearing toward the north. It's moving along at about 10 miles an hour, skating along the Gulf of Mexico. And those waters, as I understand it, in the Gulf are still extremely warm. Sitting at about 90 degrees, and normally those waters should be in the 70s. It'd be a pretty odd time to have them in the 80s, and for them to be 90 degrees is a very ugly situation. The raw sewage and pure funk that they're dumping out of New Orleans is probably creating some sort of a methane gas generator. It's killing all of the oxygen in the Gulf, and it's causing a fermentation process, and so that fermentation is bringing up the heat of the Gulf of Mexico. So we sure feel for the people down in there. It's got to be a pretty ugly situation. Apparently, people who had evacuated from Houston and were heading toward Louisiana are now having to turn around and creating extra worse traffic jams and hardship and costs. And gosh darn it, the oil and gas industry is just loving it. They're making out like bandits. Sure feel for everybody down there.
Avec ses gros billets pour que la bête crache, tu l'as fait bien baver. L'offre de la lune avec ses billets pour que la bête crache, tu l'as fait bien baver.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of bands out there that say they don't have nothing to do with anarchy. Well, we eat, sleep, and drink anarchy, man.